Good morning. Certainly is a pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity, of course, to spend this time looking at some things about our Savior. When we study about the life of Christ in the Gospels, many times, especially as we get to the last week of Jesus' life, I ask people to look in their Bibles in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, look at where Jesus comes into Jerusalem, what chapter that is, and to count how many chapters are devoted to that last week in his life. And what we see is that about 25, as much as 40% in one of the Gospels, is devoted to a single week in his life. And then as we move beyond that, we see the last chapter, basically, in each of them, devoted to the resurrection and the things that happen between the resurrection and the ascension. And we add into that some information in Acts chapter 1 that also helps us to look at what happened during that period of about 50 days between the death of Christ and the day of Pentecost. And the emphasis then throughout the rest of the New Testament is on the importance of the resurrection. The resurrection is without any doubt a single element of Christianity that distinguishes it from every other religious system that exists in this world. There are others that had the idea that somehow life goes through a cycle and that have a circular idea of life. That's seen in a lot of pagan imagery. But the idea of God coming to earth, dying on a cross, and being raised again was something completely foreign to the pagans and completely foreign to the ideas of the Jews who rejected Jesus and did not accept him as the Messiah. It's fundamental to our faith. And yet in the society that we live in today, people are constantly looking for ways to diminish the significance of Jesus and what he did. And a clear part of that is to deny the resurrection, to diminish the importance of that element of the doctrine of Christ. There are many who even today claim to be preaching the gospel, but they preach it in a way that basically takes out the sacrificial element, takes out the concept of transformation, renovation of a new life, that are all elements brought in because of the resurrection. So this morning I'd like for us to use our time in the class period to look at some things, and I may have gotten the wrong control, there it goes, to look at some things from the point of Jesus' death and on through some things about his resurrection and even beyond that to what happens in the days leading up to Pentecost and to reflect on the importance of that and the impact that it had in the lives of the people that were there. We're not looking at a dead body. We're not talking just about somebody who died on a cross and that was the end of it. But there's a significance to what happens, and I want us to look at that, especially starting out with the perspective of one of the soldiers who was there. I think we probably have a fair idea of what the role of soldiers, Roman soldiers, in executions would have been. Many of these men had probably become calloused to death. They maybe had been involved in it in war, and if they had already been in this role of executors for some time, they had been responsible for nailing other men to crosses, they'd been responsible for beheading other men, they had had a role in killing people. And so the idea of being involved in death by itself was maybe not anything all that foreign or difficult for these men. Yet, one of the gospel accounts emphasizes for us the perspective of a soldier who looked upon what was happening that day. He saw three criminals executed that day. Luke's account tells us that they admitted that they were guilty. Luke chapter 23, verses 39 to 41. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." So Jesus was crucified between these two guilty men. They recognized their guilt. But think about it from the perspective of this soldier. He very well heard that conversation, perhaps. He knew something about the record of these men. These two are not denying their guilt, but what about that Jew in the middle? What about that one who seemed to be different than the others? And in fact, during the entire time that he was on the cross, his behavior was different. He was hated. He was ridiculed by others. But he didn't react to that. He didn't lash out at the others. How many men facing an execution like Jesus did would demonstrate the kind of control that he had, self-control that he had? But it wasn't just that he had control of himself, that he accepted it in silence. We might even imagine that. That man in the middle went to the point of offering forgiveness to the people who had crucified him. And when you look at the sayings of Jesus on the cross, the seven different expressions that we find recorded in the Gospels, when he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," it's recorded exactly after he was nailed to the cross. I believe the primary application of that is to the very soldiers who were involved in his execution. We know that the concept is extended way beyond that later on. But the immediate context, the soldiers heard Jesus say that. Jesus asking for forgiveness for the very men who had brutally nailed him to the cross. Would that have not have made an impression on those men and on this particular soldier? And how do you explain the women that were there? Again, from the soldier's perspective, we don't know how much he knew about the things leading up to the cross and to the sentencing of Jesus. We don't know how much he had heard about Jesus of Nazareth during the time before that. But now, as Jesus is there on the cross, there's this group of women at the foot of the cross. They are mourning his death. They're suffering because of that. And among them, perhaps he heard a conversation that took place that John records for us between Jesus and his own mother and the disciple who was beside her. Would he not have heard something about that story? Maybe inquired something about that story? What's the significance of Jesus' mother standing there watching him as he was hung on the cross to us? What does that tell us? What did Jesus believe about himself throughout all of his life and all of his ministry? How had he come to be? It's okay to answer. He was born of what? Or of whom? He was born of a virgin. Of human beings that were present when Jesus preached and when Jesus died. In fact, of the human beings that were present throughout Jesus' life. Who was the only one who knew firsthand, for sure, how Jesus was conceived? Mary. Now, somebody might kind of come up with a story that she had just invented this story about the virgin conception of Jesus, and that it was just to cover up some sin that she had committed. But all indications are that now her husband is dead. We have no mention of Joseph throughout the entire ministry of Jesus. We believe that he probably had died before that. And now they are killing her son because he believes he's God. Because he believes that his birth was different than the birth of every other man. Would a mother stand by and watch her son die under those circumstances if it were all a lie? Would her own pride be so great as to watch her own son suffering because he believed a lie that she had been telling for 30-some years? It's difficult to imagine that. Mary's silence as Jesus was hanging on the cross is one of the evidences that helps us to understand and to believe in the claim of his divinity. The other thing that would have stood out about Jesus, how many men had this soldier heard pleading for mercy, pleading to their gods, begging for mercy, begging for forgiveness, begging for clemency at the hour of death? Jesus did not do that. Jesus did not seek forgiveness. He was confident in his own death. Luke 23, verse 46 says, when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. He did not ask for forgiveness. I wonder how many of us facing our own death at that moment would take advantage, if we're lucid, to make one more request to the Lord. If there's something we have overlooked, please forgive us. Jesus had overlooked nothing. Jesus had never sinned. And so he could face death with a confidence of where he was going and to trust his Father. That would have made an impression on the soldiers that were hearing that. And it did make an impression. It's the verse after this, Luke 23, verse 47, that says, so when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, certainly this was a righteous man. There was something different about Jesus, even from the perspective of the soldier who watched him die. Matthew brings in some other details about things that would have had an impact for this soldier. Matthew chapter 27, verse 54, tells us of an earthquake that occurred. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, truly this was the Son of God. It wasn't by chance that those natural occurrences took place that day. They were not natural on that day. The earthquake had a purpose. The same earthquake that tore the veil of the temple. The darkness that had occurred for 3 hours. It was not a solar eclipse. It was a miracle brought on by God to show them the importance of what was being done that day. And these things had an impact on the people who were present, including that soldier. The confession made, Mark chapter 15, verse 39. Mark chapter 15, verse 39 says, so when the centurion who stood opposite him saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. One of the greatest confessions made on that day, made by a Roman soldier who was there responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. Now, I want us to move a little bit beyond this. That's the perspective of the soldier. Let's talk about a little bit about the men who buried Jesus' body. What were the names of the two men who were responsible for the burial of Jesus? Joseph of Arimathea, who donated the space for the burial. And who else? Nicodemus were the two. The involvement of those two men also says some very interesting things to us about what was going on that day, and even in comparison with the faith or lack of faith of other people. When we think about the Sanhedrin, is our impression of the Sanhedrin positive or negative? I think pretty much uniformly negative. Kind of like Pharisees. We say the word Pharisee, it's negative to us. While it would not have been negative to the Jews at that time as a general rule, they were looked up to. And even the Sanhedrin generally would have been looked up to because of what we know happened in the life of Christ and the life of the apostles. They have a very negative image for us. But when we look today at political bodies, you can look at the Senate, the U.S. Senate, or the Brazilian Senate. And we look at groups like that, many times with a very negative impression, because we look at the overall behavior of these governing bodies. But are all senators equal? Were all members of the Sanhedrin equal? No, and that's one of the things brought out to us in this burial account. When we look at what Joseph of Arimathea did, Matthew chapter 27. Matthew 27, verses 57 to 58. Now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him. He requested permission to bury the body of Jesus. We know that he used his own tomb. It tells us in verse 60 that he laid it in a new tomb that had been hewn out of rock. That fact is also significant to help to defend the fact of the resurrection. There was not a possibility of mixing up with other bodies that were already in that tomb. It was a new tomb that had been hewn out of rock. There wasn't going to be another escape route for somebody to sneak in to steal the body. Luke chapter 23, verse 53, adds just a little bit more information. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen, and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before. And in John 19, verse 41, just remembering the facts of what we know that happened involving Joseph taking the body for burial. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. In the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. So all of these reminding us that whatever theory somebody might try to come up that they confused the body were not valid theories. There was only one body in the tomb. That would not be the normal case. Normally, they would bury different people in the same tomb. It's the same practice that's used in Brazil. I've seen them put as many as a dozen people into the same tomb. Dozen bodies. And that was the kind of a thing that they did in the tombs back then. But Jesus was the only one in that. So there's no confusing of the location, confusing the body, saying that a different body was missing that day. We also see that Joseph managed a quick burial. Makes the comment here that it was near the place of his crucifixion. That was important for them to be able to accomplish the burial, respecting the preparation that was being made for the Sabbath. Back in Mark chapter 15, verse 42. Now when evening had come, because it was the preparation day, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came and asked for the body. So this was done hurriedly. In fact, we know that there was the intention to go back afterwards to continue to complete the process of the preparation of the body. So that was the role of Joseph of Arimathea. But who was Joseph of Arimathea? We know that he was a wealthy man. We saw that in Matthew 27. But we also know that he was a member of the Sanhedrin, brought out to us in Luke chapter 23, verse 50. So Joseph not only had the generosity as a wealthy Jew to provide a place for Jesus' burial, if he was a member of the Sanhedrin, we know he was in some way involved in the deliberations that had led to the conviction of Jesus by the Sanhedrin, when they sent him on to the Romans to be crucified. Tells us in Matthew 27, verse 57, that he was a disciple of Jesus. But then look at what John 19 adds to that. We bring in the information from the different Gospels. In John 19, verse 38, not only was he a disciple, but it says here that he was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for fear of the Jews. And what kind of an impression does that make for us of Joseph of Arimathea? He was secretly a disciple. Is that the way we learn that we should be disciples of Christ? Do we obey the gospel and then hide it from everybody? I've heard of cases where somebody obeyed the gospel and waited months to tell their family. Does that bother you when you hear of a case like that? It bothers me. I have a problem with that. Because if we're unwilling to confess Christ in an evil and adulterous generation, what does he say that he will be unwilling to do? Confess us to his Father. If we will not confess him openly to our peers, he will not confess us to his peer. And so I do have a problem with that. But here it describes Joseph as being a disciple, but secretly for fear of the Jews. We are told he was a good and just man. We already looked at that in Luke chapter 23, verse 50. And I want to come back to this aspect of his secret discipleship in just a little bit. One other thing that we're told about Joseph is that he was one who waited for the kingdom. Mark chapter 15, verse 43. And maybe that helps us to understand a little bit about the idea of being a secret disciple, that he was still waiting for things to unfold. He didn't understand perhaps exactly what his role would be until the arrival of the kingdom. And so it tells us in Mark 15, 43, that he himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, and he, coming and taking courage, went into Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. What we're seeing happen this day is a step forward in the confidence of Joseph as a disciple. He's taking courage. He is now openly confessing his faith, even if for some time he had held that quietly. And so the question comes to us, how would a good man have participated in the Sanhedrin when Jesus was condemned by that body? We're told he was a good and just man, a disciple of Jesus, and he was there when that body condemned Jesus. Luke 23, verse 50. Now behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, a good and just man. He had not consented to their decision indeed. He was from Arimathea, the city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. Do all members of the Senate agree with every decision that's made? Do all members of the Supreme Court agree with every decision that's made? We know that's not the way these things work. And it's not the way the Sanhedrin worked. I don't know what majority was required for that, but obviously a majority voice spoke louder than the minority dissent. But Joseph was among the minority dissent. He did not agree with that decision. And when he took the body of Jesus and made that request, he was now openly declaring his faith. At a time when others, in fact, where were the disciples of Jesus during the trial of Jesus? What did they do after Jesus was arrested in the garden? They fled. And we see some of them back there at the time of the crucifixion. They're there amongst the onlookers and observing and participating in some way. But Jesus' own disciples had tried to maintain their faith in secret. What had Peter done while Jesus was being tried? Denied Jesus three times. Joseph of Arimathea was a disciple, not openly, for some time. But now he has come and asked for the body of Jesus and is showing his honor to Jesus, his service to him in his action at the burial. And then another leader participated in this, Nicodemus. What do we know about Nicodemus? Is this the first? Joseph of Arimathea is introduced to us at the time of the burial of Jesus. When is Nicodemus introduced to us? During his ministry. How many times does Nicodemus come up during the ministry of Jesus? Before this burial episode. Anybody know? Off the top of your head? I'm not good at keeping track of things like that either, but we're going to see him come up two other times. First of all, in John 3, without any doubt, the most famous reference to Nicodemus. That conversation that he had with Jesus when he went by night. And again, we know that Joseph was a disciple, but not openly. We normally deduce that going by night was probably for a similar reason. The Nicodemus probably was not willing to openly declare his faith by coming to Jesus in the midst of a multitude in the daytime. But as Jesus had what seems a disappointing visit to Jerusalem, he couldn't trust the superficial faith of those who had declared some sort of faith in him. And then Jesus is about to leave Jerusalem in this, and Nicodemus comes. Here's a leader of the Jews, a man of influence. He'd be an asset to the kingdom, as most people would look at those kinds of things. And yet Jesus says, you don't have anything, you're not bringing anything of value to me. You need to be born again. You need to start all over. Certainly something to humble him. And at the same time to teach us an important lesson. So we know that account of John chapter 3. In John chapter 7, Nicodemus comes up for the second time. John chapter 7, verses 50 and 51. Nicodemus, he who came to Jesus by night, being one of them, said to them, does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he's doing? So now we see Nicodemus as a dissenting voice in the Sanhedrin at an earlier occasion, not just at the final trial of Jesus. It's possible that Nicodemus and his words here gave some confidence to Joseph of Arimathea to stand up later on. And there maybe was an influence for good even amongst the Sanhedrists. We also know, we get to John, that he was involved as well in the burial of Jesus. It was not just Joseph. But in John chapter 19, continuing the reading there in verse 39, and Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. Then they took the body of Jesus, bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb, in which no one had yet been laid. So Nicodemus was involved now in the burial of Jesus, along with Joseph of Arimathea. I believe what we see is that both of these men became bolder. And they became bolder at the lowest point. At the point that it would have been easiest to have denied Jesus. When they take that body off the cross, how do the Jews see Jesus? Wasn't he a defeated failure at that moment? How would the devil have seen Jesus? Wouldn't he have been inclined to think that he had won the battle? Jesus is dead. You know, it's important to believe in Jesus after the resurrection, and we're going to see that thousands of people do that. These men believed in Jesus after the crucifixion. They demonstrated their faith in Jesus at the low point, at a moment when it would have been very easy to have just given up. What did the apostles do after the death of Jesus? Weren't they scattered, walking around with their chins dragging the ground, going back to fishing and questioning, doubting, not really understanding or not believing completely in those promises that Jesus had made about the resurrection? And yet these two men, who had objected to the crucifixion, come forward now and take the body and show their respects in burying the body of Jesus. They're willing to be identified now as disciples of Jesus at a time when it appears that the cause is defeated. You know, it's easy to jump on the bandwagon for the victory celebration. But at a moment when the cause appears to be defeated, to come forward and say, I believe, is much more difficult. And I believe we see something of strong faith in these men in their action at the time of Jesus' death. If there was cowardice at being a quiet or secret disciple, or coming by night, the set references we already looked at the time of the burial, they took courage. They demonstrated that courage and that confidence in Jesus. Okay, now I'd like for us to think about one more aspect in what's happening with the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus. To think about the role of his enemies. The enemies of Jesus helped. I've sometimes imagined a pretty pathetic parallel, but I'm not a very good chess player. When I play chess, if I can look ahead two of my own moves, I'm doing well. I've talked to good chess players who will tell me they can envision ahead 8 to 10 moves, their own plus the opponent's. I admire that ability. I have not read these big, thick books about it. I don't have the mind to follow all that strategy and so on, but I admire the people who can do that. Got a friend down in Brazil who's an excellent chess player, and he tells me that's about how far ahead he can look. I don't play chess with him. But using that pretty inadequate comparison, I've sometimes imagined God is kind of this master chess player. That as he makes his move, he already knows what the enemy's going to do and how he's going to use that to where he can get to his objective. And so he's looking way ahead, and it doesn't really matter what the enemy does because God already has it under control. And he's going to bring about the result that he wants. The enemies helped in what they did. The adversaries of Jesus were concerned about his tomb, and so they arranged for soldiers to guard the tomb. Matthew chapter 27, verses 65 and 66. Again, after Jesus was laid in that tomb, it then tells us what happened behind the scenes that these leaders came and they asked for a way to guard the tomb, for soldiers to guard the tomb, because verse 64 they had said, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people he has risen from the dead. They were concerned that people would believe in the resurrection, but they didn't believe it was going to happen. They just wanted to prevent a false story of the resurrection from being circulated. So they asked for soldiers, and Pilate said to them, you have a guard, go your way, make it as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. So exactly how many soldiers were involved in that guard, there are different estimates, but there were enough there to be able to make sure that these disciples, weak and disorganized as they were not going to come in there, roll away the stone, take the body and hide it somewhere, and claim that Jesus had been buried. Or had been raised from the dead. So on the third day, the tomb was empty. That is perhaps the single most astounding and important fact related in the history of the world. The tomb was empty. If that tomb had not been empty, there would be no reason for us to be here. If we did not believe that that tomb was empty because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there'd be no reason for us to be here. Paul makes that statement very clearly, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I've spent the last couple of days around a couple of people who kind of get excited about the sport of football. They kind of like football. I don't know nearly as much about football as my sister-in-law does, but I do know that it's common practice among coaches of football teams, high school, college, professional, whatever, to watch. We used to talk about watching the tapes. I don't know if they even use tape anymore for this, but to watch the recordings of prior games played by the opponent, watch them playing against different opponents to see how different ones were able to penetrate their defense or to stop their offense or whatever, to learn the strategy, to be able to see the whole thing. And of course, it would be a major scandal that would bring down all kinds of consequences if somebody were actually to steal the playbook of the opponent. What did the Apostle Paul do in 1 Corinthians 15? 1 Corinthians 15, Paul basically says, okay, here's the playbook. Here is our most vulnerable point. If you want to take down Christianity, all you need to do is disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's it. That's all it takes. And he's right. That's it. That is all it would take. Disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you have taken down all of our faith. We're left with nothing. Because that's what distinguishes Christianity from every other religious system out there. The Buddhists don't say that Buddha was raised from the dead, but we say that Jesus was raised from the dead. We believe that he was raised from the dead. And that faith is fundamental to our confidence and our service and our reason for existence. The enemies did not deny that the tomb was empty. That fact is one of the things that helps us as we come to these conclusions. In fact, Matthew chapter 28 tells us they tried to bribe the guards to give another explanation, and they're even willing to try to cover the backs of these guards when they would be called into question for the idea of the body having been stolen. Matthew 28, verse 11. Now while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all the things that had happened. When they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. That's a pretty dangerous thing for a soldier to say, isn't it? I was asleep at my post, and the enemy came in and stole away, in this case, a body. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will appease him and make you secure. So we'll cover you on this one. We'll find a way to convince the governor not to punish you for that. But their plan has failed. If they had never posted a guard, they would have had a more plausible argument. If they had never asked Pilate to post a guard, then they could have said, well, nobody was there, nobody knows what happened, surely the disciples came and stole it away. They would have had a much stronger argument against the resurrection. They defeated themselves when they asked for that guard. And they strengthened our faith by asking for that guard. The enemies of Jesus helped us. Now, there are other explanations of the resurrection of Jesus, of the empty tomb. There are other ways that people have tried to tell us that Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. They've suggested that the disciples and Mary and the Marys and so on went to the wrong tomb. That story began to be circulated way after, not at the time of the facts that occurred. Some have come up with a theory of hallucinations, that the people that saw the risen Christ actually just saw hallucinations of that. pretty impressive to get a hallucination that involves 500 people at the same time. You know, individuals might have hallucinatory visions, but 500 people at the same time. In hallucinations, you don't have the opportunity to touch someone and to touch the scars of where he had been injured. You don't eat with him if it's just an hallucination. Those kinds of explanations, to try to explain the empty tomb in other ways, came up long after the fact. The story circulated at the time was that the body had been stolen. And the very story of the idea of the body being stolen runs into all kinds of problems at the time. I think most of us are familiar with the idea of revisionist history. Most of us struggle with a tendency to practice revisionist history. I don't know how many times I've had the sad responsibility to try to deal with trying to help sort out a problem of somebody's marriage gone bad and a divorce. And after the fact, the sequence of things changes. The reasons change. The story changes as a person tries to sometimes justify in his own mind a course of action that's different than what he can justify biblically. That's revisionist history in personal lives. We see revisionist history when people try to go back and try to change the role that women or that homosexuals or that other ethnic groups had in certain historical events and to glorify that in a different way. It's revisionist history. We're all subject to that possibility. And as we look at what happens with the story of the resurrection, as time passed, people came up with their stories to try to get around the facts. But what happened in the time immediately after the tomb was found empty? 7 weeks later, 3,000 people confessed their faith in Jesus Christ as the risen Lord in the same city where he had been crucified and buried and the tomb had been found empty. Doesn't that tell us something? Doesn't that very fact of 3,000 baptisms in Acts chapter 2 stand as an evidence of the facts of what had happened? When we want to know about something, the normal rule is that we want to get to the eyewitnesses. We want to get to the people closest to the event. If there's a car wreck and the police come to try to figure out what happened, they'll look at the evidences that are there, the physical evidences, but they'll also start asking of the people that were present. Maybe people in the vehicles, maybe pedestrians that were nearby. They're going to ask for eyewitness accounts of what happened. If the car wreck happened across town 2 weeks ago, and you weren't even anywhere close to it, are the police going to come and knock on your door and ask you to tell them about it? You weren't there. You don't have that evidence. So when we want to know about historical facts, we want to get the information that comes from the people closest to the event. So many of the attacks that are being made, even on the divinity of Jesus today, are being made by people thousands, 2,000 years removed from the facts, denying the conclusions that were reached by people who were there. 3,000 people converted 7 weeks after the death of Jesus Christ. Now think about that. That means that multitude did not buy the story that the leaders in Jerusalem were circulating. They didn't believe that the body was stolen. 7 weeks have passed now. The body has not been discovered. Where did they hide it? Where's the trail of blood as they took that body out of the tomb? Nobody involved in this is cracking. Nobody is giving up. This is a conspiracy conceived by a handful of confused, uneducated men that they've now been able to get hundreds of people and now amplifying that to thousands of people to buy into it, and not a single person speaking up and saying, well, it's not exactly what happened. It's a unified message of all of these disciples after that fact. The enemies helped with what they did in sealing the tomb. We've already talked about that. But now think about another aspect of what happens in this 7 weeks. We know that on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, there were people there from all over the place. People that had come to Jerusalem to celebrate these feasts. Many of these people would not have come for the Passover, gone home, and come back for Pentecost. Many of them would have stayed right in that region, maybe right in Jerusalem during that time. What was one of the last and one of the most memorable miracles Jesus had worked during his ministry? Name of the towns up there. What did he do in Bethany? He raised Lazarus. What's the distance between Jerusalem and Bethany? Maybe 3 miles. Something like that. Not even a good morning run for some of you guys. To go from Jerusalem out to Bethany. You got 7 weeks in Jerusalem. The city is in a stir about all this stuff with Jesus. First, it was the arrival of Jesus in the city a few days before the feast, the confrontations he had with the leaders, then these trials that were public, the murder, the crucifixion of Jesus that was public, and then starts circulating all this stuff about the empty tomb and the story that the body was stolen, and different ones saying, but I saw him. 500 people saying, but we saw him. All these things circulating around. You got 7 weeks in Jerusalem. Would you hike a couple miles out to Bethany to go see if Lazarus was really alive? I would have. I'm pretty sure I'd want to know. And I'd want to take advantage of something that close by. Let me see it firsthand. How many people passed by the house of Lazarus? We're not told about that in the scriptures. But I think we're given enough information for us to realize that that would have been a natural thing to have done. And very possibly one of the things that helped to contribute to those conversions that happen when we get to the day of Pentecost. These people, even who come from other places, have had time to be examining the evidences. It's very possible that Luke wrote his account of the gospel while Paul was in jail in how do you say that city? Caesarea, thank you. I can do it in Portuguese. Those are the hardest words, the ones that are pronounced almost the same in Portuguese as they are in English. And after 21 years of saying them in Portuguese, sometimes I just forget how to say them in English. I forget a lot of other things too. Anyway, it's believed that Luke may very well have written his gospel, or at least accumulated the facts for it, while Paul was in Caesarea, whatever that name is, when he was close to the place, because he makes the point that he made it a point to verify the facts, to talk to people, to get the eyewitness accounts. If Luke did that several years later, would not some of those Jews who were in Jerusalem have done the same thing during these weeks that passed? The proximity, both in time and place, of the resurrection of Lazarus is one of the things that would have helped to lead to that evidence. And how many other witnesses? How many of those 3,000 Jews had talked to some of the 500 that Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15 had seen Jesus at one time? The evidences were there, and those evidences brought them to that decision. And it's not just those 3,000. We know that the church in Jerusalem multiplied in the months and years that followed as more and more people had opportunity to hear this message. The disciples themselves. The disciples were confused, disorganized. They didn't have the way to plot this conspiracy to be able to get the body of Jesus and invent this whole doctrine of the resurrection. In fact, one of the attacks that's being made on Christianity in our time are people who are trying to tell us that the doctrine of the resurrection of Christ was a doctrine that was developed in decades or centuries after the fact. That it was not what Jesus himself claimed, it was not what the original believers claimed. Tell you what, people that are saying that just don't know their history. Some of the strongest defenses of the resurrection of Christ come in some of the first books written in the New Testament. There is a consistency of the story between all these different authors from the earliest books of the New Testament. This is not a doctrine that was invented in the second or third century, and somehow they tried to fit it back into that. In fact, the same thing is true when we talk about the deity of Christ. There are people that try to give us the idea that the doctrine of the divinity of Christ was a doctrine that was somehow invented 300 or 400 years later. No way. The language used in the New Testament is the language of praise to God in speaking to Jesus Christ from the earliest of the epistles. The early disciples believed in the divinity of Christ, but it wasn't something they invented. They were a confused, disorganized lot, but they came to be convicted of the facts. Thomas, we sometimes refer to as doubting Thomas. Thomas helped us out. He insisted on seeing facts to come to a conclusion, and then confessed his faith, my Lord and my God. But as we look on to what happened with those disciples, in the same way that Mary would not have watched her son be crucified if she knew that it was a lie, we have biblical evidence record of some of this, historical records that suggest that many would say all but one of the apostles were executed because of their faith in Jesus Christ. You're going to die because of a conspiracy and a lie that you helped to concoct 20 or 30 or 40 years earlier? It just doesn't fit the facts. Doesn't fit human nature. It's not the way people act. But these disciples were imprisoned, they were killed because of their conviction that Jesus had in fact been raised from the dead. And so now for us, those facts remain. There are people doing things today, doing their very best to try to discredit the gospel record. Authors like Dan Brown want to destroy our faith in Jesus Christ. Many liberal theologians coming out of seminaries and filling pulpits in different denominations don't believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Many would try to teach a message of the gospel that somehow takes away the ugly parts of sacrifice and of blood being shed and of sin and of repentance or forgiveness. We can't take those things out of the gospel record. They are a part of that fundamental message, so much so that Paul in Romans chapter 6 ties our transformation of conversion in with the very same facts of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. We can't separate those things. We can't have Christianity without the resurrection, and we cannot have Christianity without repentance and conversion and transformation in our lives. And those who want to water it down, want to whittle away at these facts, are seeking to destroy the very fundamental facts of our faith. The tomb was empty. And the explanations that have been given for that, to try to explain it away, just don't hold water. The only plausible explanation that stands 2,000 years after the fact is the only plausible explanation that stood 7 weeks after the fact. Jesus is the risen Lord. The tomb was empty because he has been risen from the grave. Questions, comments, according to that clock back there, we've got a couple of minutes for that. Anybody wants to add anything in or have any questions about that, I'd be happy to hear them. If not, may we allow the impact of what happened in Jerusalem always keep us on track. I was, one time in my life, I've been involved in the construction of a house, and that was down in Brazil. Construction methods in Brazil of houses do not use stud walls, hollow walls to fill with insulation like is done here. The construction is done with blocks and with stucco and such, and that means that the houses are fairly heavy. And so it's important that the foundation be done right. And when I was involved in building our house, I insisted on soil sampling and an engineer to decide just how deep it was going to be necessary to go with the different stakes or whatever they call them in English to hold up the foundation of that house. And as I've looked at a lot of other houses, you go to a house 2 or 3 years after it's been built and there's a big crack going down the wall. Or sometimes big separations between a wall and a ceiling. And in every case when that happens, the first thing that will be asked, what's the foundation like on this house? It's the same thing with our faith as Christians. When we are weak, when we find ourselves continually stumbling back into sin, when we are questioning God about things that happen in our day-to-day lives, those are cracks in the walls. Those are separations between the ceilings and the walls. Where do they come from? We need to go back to the foundation. We need to build up the foundation. Because if we can see Jesus Christ as he is, as great as he is, as the risen Lord, that'll help us to stay on track. Let's use it that way, and I hope it'll help all of us to do that. Thank you for your time.
This will be used for songs too, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll show you what's the next one and let you coordinate however that has to be.
Okay, don't show everybody, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, now that one I can just close out. And it's going to be this one for the sermon.
All right. We'll embed it with the song, so is it up here, you just keep going straight.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it's opening up there. Okay. Okay. It's in your hands.
All right.
I think this one may be a different format on the screen size. That won't be a problem, will it? It's the wider, or not as wide and higher. I don't think I was coming all the way down to the bottom of the screen. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
This should be a save.
Okay, hit one more just to make sure we're...
Yeah, it looks like we're on the screen. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good enough. I did that one place, and they had all theirs formatted for the narrow, wider. I mean, for the wider, not as high thing, and my stuff was going off the bottom of the screen. But that doesn't look like it'll be a problem here.
Well, let's try one that actually tests it.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Good.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Jared.
Morning.
How are you this morning?
Good.
Good.
Jared, are you here to cut the sidewalk? Hi. Here's the sun.